This is my first game of the day. I want you to guess what this is from, okay?
This is one of the real... It's not one of your real games, though.
Not one of my real games. But it is a real game. It's just not one of my real games.
Yeah.
You ready?
Mm.
Yeah? Okay, I'll do it line by line, and you can tell me... You pause me in between each line, okay?
Hmm.
I might have known the bitch could bite. I might have known the cat had claws. I might have guessed your little secret. Oh, yes, the virtuous Fontaine.
Yeah.
Yeah, you got it now?
Yeah, I mean, I know
what
you
is
went...
It?
It's, yeah, it's Les Miserables.
I went to see it in the theatre.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I sort of knew... I knew that, so I imagined it must have been that or cats, so...
Cat. Well, I guess because there's a cat in there.
There's claws.
Well, there's a cat. There's a part of the lyrics, isn't it?
Right, yeah. And there's a cat in the musical as well, right? There's like that's part of like Fontaine. He has like a little cat in his pocket that he takes around.
Fontaine's a woman.
the version I saw. Fontaine was played by they rewrote it as a
that's
man.
That's the and German version.
And
yeah.
he had a little cat in his pocket.
That's the German version. Fontaine Kessler.
Fontaine Kessler. He would say something particularly cutting, and the cat would pop his head up and go, meow.
Yeah, I like that, but that's a good version. Because the English version has a little bit of, like, you know, Barney in it, but not enough, not as much as the German version.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, other moments from the German version spring to mind. You know, the big sing-song in the bar, they kind of reconceive that, and... they kind of do a riff on Inglourious Basterds, and there's a big shootout.
Drei Gläser. You know, remember that song?
Yeah, Drei Gläser. Und Gläser. Zwei Gläser. Nein Gläser. Drei Gläser.
Yeah.
And they just...
My favourite different one is the American Les Miserables, where in the song at the beginning, where Jean Valjean is singing his prison number, international audiences will know it as 24601. But in the American version, it's 246010. We have all the biggest numbers. It's America. It's bigger in America. They had to have the biggest number, so they added an extra one. It doesn't quite work for the cadence of a lot of the songs, but there's a lot to choose from around the world of the different international versions of Les Miserables. What's another favourite of yours?
I mean, the Australian one has got to be up there.
Oh yeah.
When I went to Perth and I saw it in Perth.
Yeah.
There's that bit where Fontaine in the Australian one, she's a woman. Back to a woman. And it's the whole I dreamed a dream thing.
Yeah.
Because they don't really have dreams in Australia because
it's upside down, isn't it? Because they dream during the day.
Right. And so it's not even they don't have hopes at all down there at all. And she just doesn't even sing a song. She just looks around baffled for about 5 minutes.
That one didn't do as well at the musical awards in Sydney, did it?
No,
that one.
No. But, you know, some people thought they could at least have just plopped in Kylie singing "I Should Be So Lucky,"
right?
Because that would actually fit really well in that bit.
My favourite, I have to say, is the North Korean version of Les Miserables. The ruling Kim family—they don't like that the peasants are uprising in it. So instead, they just have the same musical, but it's about a police officer chasing a man who stole some bread, and then when they catch him, they put him back in prison again. It's a lot more simple.
Yeah, shorter.
There's
better.
No barricade or anything. Better.
Yeah.
Shorter. A lot shorter. A lot shorter. It's actually only two numbers, you know?
Mm. 2-4.
Adam is the host now. The dynamic works better when Adam is the host. Adam prefers to the host. And Joe prefers to the participant. It's better overall when Adam is the host and Joe is the participant. Let it never be spoken of again. The ghost. 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 The ghost.
Hello, and welcome to the Movies You Forgot podcast with me, your host, Adam Richmond. This is the show where we chat about the movies or films we forgot we'd even seen in the first place. You know that feeling when someone says a film And for a split second, you think, well, what is that film? And then a light bulb. And you go, oh, yeah, I've seen that. That is a movie you forgot. Some people take issue with that. The second you forgot that, you could just sort of, they seem to think it's just like, oh, you forgot a movie. No, you didn't forget the movie. You know, you'd even forgot it. And like, this is where me and Joe, we chat about those kinds of movies in a nice, safe way.
How about that, hey? Canon episode 97 and way over 100 in the non-canons. Mm. And that's the first thing. You're changing the intro there. You've added a new thing in. You've thought, now's about time to explain what a movie you forgot is. I commend it. Good hosting.
Thanks. And here he is. I'm joined as ever by my co-host, sometimes host, best pal, a big-brained Les Mis lover, Mr. Joe Devine.
That, well, I might have known the cat had claws, Adam Richmond.
On today's episode, this was picked by voted for. It wasn't picked. Let's not overdo things. Our Discord followers, you can join the Discord, link in the show notes, where you join and you can chat. It's like a message board thing. And sometimes me and Joe will do live audio performances where we'll chat. But our Discord followers, they voted on a list of movies and everyone. And I pegged it, didn't I, Joe? I pegged which one they'd pick.
You did peg it, yeah. Would you want to hear from me what the votes were, the percentages in the other films?
Yeah, and also you could read out some of the, you know, some of the comments.
I will do. Okay, so there were four, as discussed, there were four films, and that's just because Adam had a bumper round at the end of last week's episode, got me with a bunch of them. So we thought we'll put it to the audience. Now, I was pretty confident that this one wouldn't win. Star Trek, of course, we know that it did with 37% of the vote. In last place, I think we both put this in last place. We thought it would be there. 17%, As Good As It Gets. People wanted that. Rain Man took 20% of the vote. And then the one that I thought people would vote for is Rocky. But of course, our members are, I mean, hilariously in some ways, more puritanical about the concept of a forget you forgot than we are. Here's some examples. Coddlefish, I want to vote for Rocky. I want to. But it absolutely isn't a forgot you forgot in my book. I voted for my most forgotten movie. Johnny Four said, one of these is a pure forgot you forgot. The other three are not. So I think, as we can see, this is where we end up leaning towards Star Trek.
Yeah, it's
so thanks, Discord audience.
Yeah, it was a fun little moment, and it's plum. It's a plum forgotter. And it's a fun little plum. Yeah, I never would have rewatched this, so I'm glad. I was glad as like, oh yeah, here's an excuse. I'll plop on the Star Trek reboot.
The Star Trek.
Well,
that's like a Hollywood bus journey, isn't it? That one?
Here's to the Letterboxd. Star Trek comes out in 2009, directed by J.J. Abrams.
Mm.
And with a script by Alex Kurtzman and Roberto Orci. Damon Lindelof, I like Damon Lindelof, he's a producer. Lost guys, Abrahams, J.J. Abrahams and Lindelof.
Yeah.
Lindelof, it's just Lindelof, but yeah, they're lost.
It's just Lindelof.
Lindelof. And here we go. I never know which way I do it first. In the cast, we got Chris Pine is James T. Kirk. Zachary Quinto is Spock. Leonard Nimoy is also Spock.
Yeah.
Eric Bernal is Captain Nemo.
Eric Bernal?
Look, we can do a little side Bernal. Carl Urban is Bones McCoy. Zoe Saldana is Uhura. And Peg is...
Montgomery.
Monty.
Scotty,
aka Scotty. John Cho is Sulu, and Anton Yelchin is Chekhov.
God bless him.
Here's the Letterboxd. 127 mins. That's 20 mins easily too long.
I mean, if not more.
The future begins. The fate of the galaxy rests in the hands of bitter rivals.
Wait. Eric Banner was Nero.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry to interrupt you. Is that why I just did a joke about Eric Bernal? Did I just say Eric Bernal?
Yeah, I just assumed you knew what you were...
Wow. I heard you say something that sounded like Bernal, so I said Bernal. But now I'm realizing Eric Banner was... Sorry, it just took me 20 seconds to click what you said in my head. I didn't know that. He really disappears into the role, hey? But it's a bad role. Sorry, go on. What were you doing? You were reading the blurb.
Yeah, no, he is Bernal. The fate of the galaxy rests in the hands of bitter rivals. One, James Kirk, is a delinquent, thrill-seeking Iowa farm boy. The other, Spock, a Vulcan, was raised in a logic-based society that rejects all emotion. As fiery instinct clashes with calm reason, their unlikely but powerful partnership is the only thing capable of leading their crew through unimaginable danger. Unimaginable. Boldly going where no one has gone before. The human adventure has begun again. I mean, what a lot of fucking gibberish.
That's so much. Do you want to hear the IMDb?
Yeah, just like at least like have the plot.
Yeah.
You know, not this waffle.
Well, how about this? The brash James T. Kirk tries to live up to his father's legacy, with Mr. Spock keeping him in check as a vengeful Romulan from the future creates black holes to destroy the Federation one planet at a time.
Right. The heart of this story is J.J. Abrams is using time travel to reboot Star Trek and create because Star Trek fans are very possessive of their thing, they don't, you know, they're like, don't touch our canon Star Trek. And so J.J.'s done a very clever thing, or so he thinks. He's created time travel in a black hole to create an alternative reality where his own Star Trek, I think it's called the Kelvin timeline. That's what the nerds call it. So whatever he then does, it's all, he's like, I know.
Because he's in an alternative timeline.
Right. And, he's thumbing his nose at the nerds, and he's going, oh, you can't get me. Can't get me.
Is that when you say thumbing the nose, is that what they do in Romeo and Juliet? A bit of nose thumbing?
Yeah.
That's the insult, isn't it? That the Capulets and the Romulets do. Romulets? The Montagues. The Romulets? Where did that come from? The Montagues and the Capulets do to each other, don't they? They sort of thumb their nose at each other, and it's seen as this very, very rude thing.
Very rude.
Very rude.
And that's what JJ did to the Star Trek fans.
He's going to start a love feud.
They were even more livid about what he did in Into Darkness, which is the sequel, where he toyed with Khan. He dared take iconic character Khan from The Wrath of Khan, recast him as Benedict Cumberbatch.
Right.
And
Benedict Cumberkhan.
Yeah. Anyway, we shouldn't talk about darkness.
Okay.
Let's just talk about light. I remember enjoying this when I saw this in the cinema at the time.
Really?
Yeah, I remember thinking, this is fun. This whips along, and it's not great, is it? This film, it's not great.
It's not terrible. It's far from terrible. I would say it's sort of it's edging on bad.
It's edging on bad.
Yeah, it's not bad. It's not like capital letters bad, but could it be bad lowercase? Yeah. Could it be bad with just a capital B and not an A and a D? Maybe, you know. I think the problem here is that it's sort of very, very, very confused. And also, time travel, maybe this is, I'm getting too deep here, too in the weeds. But my opinion, as a fan of sci-fi, is that time travel is something you save for later when you don't have any more ideas. Now, I'm glad that you just explained why J.J. Abrams used this initially with the idea of setting up this franchise whereby he could then make any decision he wanted to. But this very much has the feel of a sort of fourth film in a franchise slowly, you know, declining in audience, whereas actually this is the first one, and I didn't like it. I thought it was, you know, edging on bad.
He wants JJ, when I say he, I mean JJ, he wants to get things going very quickly. He doesn't want to take any time, but he has got a lot of work to do. He's kicking off a new reboot of a franchise. So there is he's faced with a quite a tricky creative problem.
Yeah.
And the solution with the time travel thing is like, okay, great. You've given yourself a back door out, and you can do these other things. I haven't got a problem with any of that. It's the elements within that Like, it's not sci-fi. This is just a Hollywood action film.
It's just an action movie, yeah.
It's just noisy, and it looks great. It stands up, but like, special effects are still pretty good. Lot of lens flare. He loves lens flare. He gets
an
so
awful
much,
lot of lens flare.
And he does that thing where, like, he does that thing where he'll have a shot of a spaceship, but then there'll be like a little zoom in, and like the camera's kind of a bit more active in those shots. And that,
it's like Paul Greengrass is making a space movie.
That's exactly right. And at the time, that did actually feel like quite a fresh approach.
I think it's neat because a lot of sci-fi, a lot of space stuff can feel fake because the camera's so still and it's all clearly very computer generated, that having it shaky like in Cloverfield, like in Cloverfield, then that's cool, isn't it?
That's cool. But yeah, this doesn't really feel like Star Trek. I loved Star Trek Next Generation growing up.
Did you?
I did, yeah. I'm not a huge fan. That. You didn't know that?
You're a Trekkie?
No. And it's also Trekker. I think it's Trekker, you're supposed to say.
I don't think it's Trekker. It's Trekkie.
I think they don't like being called Trekkies.
Who's they?
Trekkers.
Okay, hold on.
I was going to say, here, virgins. Virgins who live with
Trekkie
their mums.
Trekkie or Trekker? Oh, interesting. Well, Trekkie and Trekker both describe Star Trek fans. Trekkie is the popular historic term often associated with the passionate convention-going fans. Trekker was adopted later, between the 70s and the 90s, by some as a more self-respecting label for serious fans, aiming to avoid potential negative stereotypes of being associated with the Trekkie moniker. I think it's fine to say either, clearly.
No, yeah, but I wasn't
wrong. You're evidently not a Trekker.
No.
If anything, you're a Trekkie.
Yeah, maybe. But I just liked the show. And it was on at 6 p.m. on BBC Two after school. And that's proper sci-fi, Picard, all the others, Data.
Yeah,
and
they'd Picard have a little, and the others. Yeah,
all the others. Yeah, yeah. Geordie LaForge.
Yeah.
But there would be a thing that there would be an alien race and there'd be some conundrum, some science-y, and they'd have to... Well, what
Sponsor
are the
of the week.
What are the ramifications of this? What does it mean if, I don't know, we land on a society and they have to, the judges are... Oh, yeah, there's one where they land on a planet and Will Wheaton, who he plays some the spotty little boy, and it's this amazing, lovely utopia, and then he's horsing around and he effectively treads on the grass where there's a sign saying, don't tread on the grass. And he's sentenced to death. What if you land on a planet, right, where if you break one small rule, you get sentenced to death?
Right.
What happens? Yeah, think about it. Just play it out in your head.
You want me to think about it?
No, I'm just like, you don't have to. I'm just like, that's how powerful the show was.
Right.
Sorry.
Did you spend a lot of time thinking about that?
It made me think, like, oh, and then they play out. They have the whole thing. I didn't have to think about it. The show thought about it for
me.
But
it's interesting you say that, though, because actually, now you're saying this, I can really see the impact that that's had on you, because you are very much someone who acts as though you've been sentenced to death for anything that you say. You say something, people don't like it a bit, and you go, oh, you're going to sentence me to death, will you? Is it death for me? Yes, it's death. You're a very sort of 0 to 10 guy, aren't you? Maybe that's the influence that, maybe you are a Trekker.
Yeah, could be. I mean, then I watched this movie, and you're like, this isn't Star Trek. You've got some famous people, well, up and comers, and they're pretty nicely cast. They kind of work, but in a movie, this isn't sci-fi. It doesn't engage with any ideas about time travel or what it means to observe a fucking planet of weird aliens. It's just big bollocks.
I don't know really. I'm a natural glutton for lots of things. A glutton for punishment, I suppose, being one of them. It's amazing to me that I've been doing this job for over 20 years now.
The whole thing was obviously good enough because, in a way, it sort of seems to be J.J. Abrams auditioned for Star Wars. He probably wouldn't have got Star Wars if he hadn't done, you know, an okay enough job with Star Trek. That seems reasonable to believe.
Yeah, and yeah, he got, I mean, after this, let's talk about JJ, because after this he does Super 8, which is also a Forgot You Forgot.
I've never seen it.
Oh, well, trust me. It's like, that's his big sort of Spielberg rip-off. Well, rip-off, homage, a lot of lens flare. I remember quite liking it, but you don't want to watch it, right? It's about these three lads, hometown in the 80s. They make goofy movies, and then, oh, something lands. It's like it's a cross between E.T., The Iron Giant, and Spielberg's growing up.
Well, can I say, I think, and this is probably just because I was born in 1990, so I missed the 80s. There's nothing more boring to me than filmmakers of a certain age remembering the 80s with their films. I just don't care. I'm not interested. And also, when they're remembering the 80s, they're remembering the 80s in America, obviously. And that's even less interesting to me than the 80s elsewhere. I'm kind of interested in the 80s in the UK. But there's something about, like, those... Oh, it was the last decade where you could have kids that really were... Not out. They were outside. They weren't on the computer. It was the last real decade, the 80s, where they were all playing, using their imaginations and playing Dungeons and Dragons. And I'm just not interested. Also, the aesthetic is boring. The clothes are rubbish. Most of the music is also not. I mean, this is ridiculous to say, obviously, but most of the music is rubbish. And there's no edge to it. It's all boring. Don't care. It just happens to be the decade that they were teenagers in, and that's why they all think about it and make movies set in it.
What about remembering the 50s? Do you like people who remember the 50s?
Don't like that either. In fact, I don't like remembering anything. I don't like it. I'd much rather all of the filmmakers decided that they needed to set every film in 2040 or something, you know, and that was it.
But you loved Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yeah, I like that film. But that's not someone like fondly remembering the 70s. That's someone like
yes, it is.
No, it's not. It's someone deliberately misremembering the 70s.
Nice. So, and then after Super 8, JJ does.
Is that the first film you could think of that I liked that was set in the past? Is that where that came from? It was like, quickly think of a film that Joe likes.
Doesn't have to quickly do it. It was right.
Do another one. Give me another one.
What's
another
Gladiator. One?
Gladiator, yeah, that's true. I do like it when people fondly remember ancient Rome. I'm totally on board with that. Like, if it's ancient history, sign me up, you know. But if it's just a couple of decades ago, unless it's the 90s when I was young, then get it out of here.
But if it was made in the 80s, that's fine, right?
No, I think they shouldn't have been allowed to make anything the whole 10 years.
So, and then he gets Star Trek Into Darkness, which is the sequel to Star Trek, which I just watched. Whilst you were watching the first one, I was ahead of you, so I thought I'll slip in Into Darkness.
I've seen it. I saw it in the cinema.
Yeah, that's okay.
But I don't remember it.
Yeah, no, it's probably too bad to be forgot. You forgot. It's,
oh,
it's,
really?
It's all the failings of the first one, and the story is even. It's the story's really badly told. Cumberbatch is an appalling villain. He's worse than Eric Banner in Star Trek.
Do you know, that's interesting about Cumberbatch, isn't it? I watched during the lockdown, the coronavirus COVID-19 lockdown, the National Theatre in the UK did this really fun thing where every Thursday they live streamed. It wasn't like live, but they played a to tape recorded live stream of one of their famous plays or performances from the last sort of 10, 20 years. And myself and my wife lived it at the time with her cousin, who was a stage director in the West End. And so he knew a lot of these people and you know, he was interested in theatre. Every Thursday during the lockdown, we sat down and we watched on the big screen in our house the theatre production. It was really fun. And one of these was Frankenstein. And Johnny Lee Miller and Benedict Cumberbatch swapped roles every performance. That was like the gimmick of the show. And I watched a version, the recorded version that they played was one where at halftime the roles swapped. In fact, that may have been the gimmick. I can't remember. Maybe they swapped every night. They swapped at halftime. Not sure. I decided that Benedict Cumberbatch was worse in both roles. That's the first thing to say. But he was much more worse in the Frankenstein's monster role. He was better as Frankenstein, the doctor, where he could just play it straight and be ordinary and be normal and be posh and be whatever. As soon as you gave him an acting challenge where he had to portray a monster, it was it was like, I'm trying to think, who does the worst impression of the Elephant Man, you know? Do you remember in Anchorman when Ron Burgundy says, "Do I amuse you?" when he's pretending to be the Elephant Man in Anchorman 2?
That I don't remember a thing about that, but yeah, okay. That sounds funny.
That was like Benedict Cumberbatch's the Frankenstein monster. And look, not to say he's obviously a terrific actor.
Is he though? Is he in what?
I think he's a compelling actor that people enjoy watching. I think he's very, very good in Sherlock, for example. There are some roles that are perfectly suited to Benedict Cumberbatch. You might not like it, but there are some roles that are perfectly suited to him. I personally think being a villain does not play to his strengths, and the Americans think he can do it because he can keep a straight face and talk in a scary accent. You know, he thinks he could play Scar from The Lion King, but he couldn't play Scar from The Lion King, and that's Benedict Cumberbatch.
It's because he's posh. They think, oh, he's the Shakespearean. They've gone for the hack Shakespearean. Oh yeah, English make great baddies.
Except he's not really Shakespearean, is he? He's just posh.
Let's plot back to Star Trek 1. Eric Banner, we're talking baddies. He's really bad, right?
The band man. Well, yeah, I mean, I would say he is. I didn't know it was him, so in a sense, maybe he's not. But further to that, I would say the character is just terrible. Awful. The character of the main, who it transpires, turns out, is the lead antagonist in the film, seems like the kind of person who you would meet at the beginning of an ordinary movie, and then within 40 minutes you realize that he was just the gatekeeper of the actual bad guy. You go, oh, thank God, there's a real villain here. This guy was just the fucking, you know, he's just the man who gets sent in to do the dirty work. No, it's really him. And their story is that it's a mining craft of ordinary people who've watched something horrible happen, and then for some reason they have all these weapons on board, and they accidentally go through time and all sorts of like crazy science shit that doesn't make any fucking sense at all. My favorite bit of the whole film, incidentally, is when at the very end, the big baddie in the bad ship is stuck in the middle of a black hole. It's taking significantly longer to implode than the planet did 20 minutes earlier in the film. Whereas, and there's much more of this red matter used, which is the material that causes the black hole. And the funny thing is that Kirk and Spock, they're on board the normal ship. They're receiving a transmission from the ship in the middle of the black hole that can't escape because it's being drawn in by gravitational forces, you know? So how does it receive the transmission?
I don't know. I'd sort of mentally tuned out at that point.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
It's because it's, this is all very, very dull.
That's one of about 10 things that are completely obviously stupid that I think they're just gambling that audiences don't know, as opposed to not knowing themselves.
I mean, that's interesting that that's your favourite moment of the movie. Do you want to know what my favourite moment of the movie is?
I'd love to. What is it?
It's the bit where Kirk is hiding under someone's bed and he's staring up at Zoe Saldana, who just takes off her clothes and you see her in her bra and pants.
Yeah.
For no reason whatsoever. It's the most gratuitous thing I've seen in, it can't be, not, I mean, I'm going to overstate it, but like in a Hollywood blockbuster, 2009,
yeah,
to think that they could, and to like pull that kind of shit. And he does it, JJ does it again in Into Darkness. He does it with Alice Eve, who for just no reason whatsoever just takes off her clothes and looks at cheeky Kirk and's like, "No, don't look at my boobies." Kirk, they make him such a horn dog in the first one, and it's supposed to be funny, but it was probably a little bit creepy then. It's really creepy.
Very creepy.
When this is your hero.
Yeah, yeah. Have you ever looked at a picture of J.J. Abrams?
Yes.
Yeah. He doesn't know about sex. He hasn't known about it until later in life, you know? And what's happened there as a teenager, I sympathize. I sympathize too. I'm not saying this is a loan to J.J. Abrams, but when I look at J.J. Abrams and then I look at the kind of films he's made and the sort of things he's interested in, I think you're the kind of person that really peaked as an adult, yeah? When you could really use those skills that you had, that you'd started developing as a child, to great effect and become a huge Hollywood producer and director, and good for you, fantastic. But let's be honest, when he was 14 years old, he didn't have a girlfriend. okay? He didn't. And I think these sorts of experiences, they contribute to how men view sex and view desires and objects, objects of desire, sorry, when they come into later years. I'm hamming up the notion of saying this guy's a nerd, so obviously he wants people to take their clothes off, but it's not quite as simple as that. It's more on a deeper subconscious level.
But it's so brazen. And then Uhura, it's a completely underwritten part. She's the love interest, and she's just Spock's girlfriend. And then to be in a bra and pants.
Sure.
It's a complete waste of a wonderful actress.
Absolutely.
And she gets the same sort of short shrift in Into Darkness as well.
The best bit of the film is the bit where she follows Spock into the lift and when just after he's watched his home planet be destroyed. And it's the moment where the film decides to reveal to you that they are romantically engaged.
Yeah, it's a nice bit there.
And she puts her hands on the side of his face and she tries to draw emotion out of him. His character arc is that his mother is a human, his father is a Vulcan. Vulcans famously, you know, prioritize logic over their emotion. They try not to show any emotion. So because he's half human, he's been, you know, teased all of his life, and the expectation is that he can't manage it. He sees emotion as some kind of weakness. So there's a lovely, very sweet scene where we, as an audience, see, oh, these people are together. We didn't know that. She's trying to, she's trying to make sure that he's okay. She says to him, like, tell me what you need. And he says, we just need to get back to normal. And it's a very sweet moment with some fantastic, compelling acting. It lasts about, I don't know, 15 seconds. It's the only time in the film where I believe anyone cares about anything or anyone else on the ship. It's like, you know, none of the other relationships or dynamics mean anything to me. That one, in that little moment, it's the only time you see these two characters together, really. And it's magic on screen because she's a terrific actor.
He's got a great cast, and they can just slot into these archetypes. We know who they are. We know who Scotty is. We sort of don't really know who Sulu is. I mean, I don't, from the original. Chekhov.
Who's Sulu? Which one?
Oh, that's John Cho.
Oh, right. Okay.
He's one, you know, take the Khan Sulu, Mr. Sulu. John Cho's great. He's got a couple of lovely moments. He gets an action moment, which is quite nice. But in this film, you've got this opportunity, like, oh, you kind of feel like you should, these are archetypes, and then you can create some fun relationships. There's no scenes with anyone. Anton Yelchin doesn't get to be anything other than a Russian accent.
It'd be fun if they're sort of nibbling away at each other, or, like, you know, they're competitive, or they're helping each other, or if they have any kind of character arc whatsoever. They don't. Their character arc is be introduced and recognized by the audience as a character that you are representing from a previous iteration of this thing, and then that's it, that's the end of it.
And take orders and say, I'm right on it, Captain, I'm moving the doodad and I can't find the yin yang. Oh, God. Tell you what, yeah, though.
It is a nightmare when you can't find the yin-yang, yet, to be
mate,
fair.
Tell me, like, the jokes, JJ's sense of humour, and I rewatched Rise of Skywalker recently, and that was his, they'd got him back to do the third one of that run of Star Wars. And the jokes in that are so shit. And then watching this again, his sense of humour, he's trying to leaven it out and create a tone. And you sort of think, okay, I can see why you're doing this.
Yeah.
But your jokes suck. And it adds at least 20 minutes of, like, all this, like, patter of, like, oh, Kirk's got to sneak onto the ship, so he's going to, like, Bones is going to give him a poison, and then his face and hands are going to balloon. And you're like, why am I watching this? Why is Scotty suddenly sucked into a pipe full of water? This has got nothing to do with the story.
I imagine more towards capital letter B, capital letter A, lowercase d, bad.
I'll tell you, oh, do you know what my second favourite bit of the movie is?
Mm-hmm.
Spock's back on Vulcan, and Vulcan's about to explode, and he's got his dad and his mum and some other people.
Winona
Ryder, his mum. The planet is imploding. It's all going to come to pieces, and they've come to this little edge of a fucking cliff, and the planet's falling to pieces. And Winona Ryder, the mother, decides to stand at the very, very edge for some reason.
Yeah.
And the transporter's swirling around them. It's taking ages. It's taken longer than it's ever taken to transport someone.
Yeah.
And the ground from under, it's the most contrived death scene I've seen for, well, a very long time. But he's got to see his mum die. and the,
I mean, it's
the
important
plot,
that he does.
The plot demands it, and so JJ's written this, and his pals have written this really dumb moment.
Well, speaking of JJ Abrams, I wonder if we might take this opportunity to go through his filmography, if you would.
But I'd got us up to Into Darkness.
Oh, you mean his directorial work?
Yeah.
So now I think this is the interesting thing about J.J. Abrams. I've written a little note to you here questioning, is J.J. Abrams the Judd Apatow of the sci-fi world? Now, the reason I say that is because J.J. Abrams has directed surprisingly few films, but he's produced or exec produced a huge number of impressive things. He's seems to be, you know, when you use the term like filmmaker, I think it's usually reserved for directors, but I think he is a filmmaker who spends more time as a producer than he does as a director, right? There's quite a lot of interesting stuff in here that he didn't direct.
Do you know, is that just because of his production company Bad Robot? Like, just because he gets the credit on the film, did he have any like sway over it?
He was the creator of Lost, right?
Yeah.
So as a starting point, he was the creator of Lost. He only directed one episode.
Yeah, the pilot.
Yeah,
but then we're not doing. Let's
TV.
Do the movies. I just wanted to.
He was a producer of Cloverfield.
Yeah, no, I know that.
Okay, you know that, but you didn't say these things. You didn't say any of these things. That's why I was saying.
No, but I know it.
But you know it. Fine. You know. Okay. You carry on. I just thought that was interesting, and that's why I compare him to Judd Apatow, because when we went through the Knocked Up episode, we discovered, didn't we, that he hadn't actually directed that many good films, but he'd produced and brought the gang together on an awful lot of good films, and I think that's why J.J. Abrams is the Judd Apatow of sci-fi.
Yeah, no, yeah. List them. I don't know this list that you're going to tell me. I'm interested. I was just checking that you'd done your homework to like, what had he has he birthed these other ones in the same way,
right?
Or is it a vanity credit? But let's.
I don't know. You'd know that.
Well, let's find out.
Do you not know that?
I'll just go, I'll know it or I didn't know it.
You'll know it or you didn't know it. Okay.
I'll know
so
it.
Did you know that he was a producer of Cloverfield in 2008?
Oh, I'll know it.
I'll know it. Okay. Do you know that he also produced Star Trek in 2009?
I'll know it. Yeah.
Okay, good. Now, beyond that, Lost finished in 2010. You mentioned Super 8 already. You know that he was the director of Mission Impossible 3, don't you?
I'll know it. Yeah.
Yeah. But that was earlier, wasn't it?
That was earlier. That was his. Yeah. That's what he got picked off his TV show alias that he also created and produced.
Yeah.
Cherry picked by Timothy Cruise.
Right.
For Mission Impossible 3.
Alias was a big popular show. Okay, so he did Mission Impossible 3, which is the one with Philip Seymour Hoffman, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's the best one.
Well, it's not the best one. It's very, very good.
It's the best one. Okay, then we're in 2013. He does Star Trek Into Darkness. Beyond that, he's a TV... we're not doing TV, are we?
No.
You won't let me do. Fine. So he's then a producer on like a number more Mission Impossible movies, including Rogue Nation and Ghost Protocol, for example.
I'll know it. Yeah,
you'll know it.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. At that point, he becomes the producer and director in some instances of the new Star Wars reboot. I think he directs two of the three, right? But he produces all of them.
I'll know it. Yeah,
you'll know it. Okay, 10 Cloverfield Lane, a follow up.
Yeah, I'll know it.
He was you just double checking that you did know that one there. Okay, and then again, Mission Impossible Fallout and Cloverfield Paradox.
Yeah, I'll know it.
Did you know? I'm including Westworld, the TV series, in here as well, because that's a really good TV series.
I didn't know that.
He was the executive producer of Westworld.
Oh, exec is nothing, mate. That is absolute.
Sometimes it is not nothing. Sometimes it is not nothing.
It's always not nothing. Always. Always.
Certainly not in everything, but a lot of the time it is. It is nothing. Did you know that he was the producer of Elizabeth Taylor, The Lost Tapes?
No, that doesn't... No. Apart from the Star Trek stuff, and there's not much sci-fi going on here. Star Wars isn't sci-fi, so I'm waiting for the... Ooh, Mr. Judd Apatow of sci-fi movies.
Well, he also produced a popular four-episode series called UFO... in 2021, that all of the conspiracy theory people watched. 2022, this was a big one. It was a short, but it was very, very popular. The Boy, the Mole, the Fox and the Horse. You must have seen that. Or you must have read it to your kids.
No, I looked at it once and it's just a self-help thing for losers.
For children?
Yeah, aka children.
I am a golden god! sucks.
Do you want to play a game?
Oh, was that not the game? Could we do my... Because I was going to do a game.
You want to do your game first? Okay.
I rattled through a half-assed memory of a Star Trek Next Generation episode. And I was thinking about Star Trek and about how just great and fun and odd a lot of the episodes are. And I know you're not a Star Trek guy. You're not a Trekker at all, right?
No, I'm not. I'm a Gator.
Why are you not a Star Trek guy?
Because I've never watched it.
Never. Yeah,
I just missed it. I was too young in the 90s. So, and then I got my Star Trek fill as a Gator with a Stargate SG-1. You know,
I'd call you a oneer.
Well, no, because there's more. There's Stargate Atlantis as well, which I also liked, and Stargate Universe, which I also liked. So you've got to go for the star or gate bit, and you can't take star, so you've got to go gate. I'm a Gator. And then I get to go rah, rah, like a Gator.
Yeah. Okay. No, that's fair enough. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read out some plot episodes from Star Trek.
Yeah.
Okay, and you have to tell me whether it's a real episode or a fake episode.
Can I tell you something really funny?
This is exactly the same as your game.
Not exactly the same, but one of my two games, the lesser of the two, I'll have you know, is very similar to this. But you go.
Great, I get the lesser game. Good.
No. Yours is better than mine. Yours is a much better version of what I've brought to the table. Route 101. You've done something better. Go on.
Okay, here we go.
Real or fake?
Real or fake. Spock's brain. That's the title. Spock collapses when his brain is surgically removed by an alien civilization. Kirk and McCoy pursue the thieves to an underground society where Spock's brain is being used as a central computer controlling daily life.
It's got to be true.
It's true.
It's true. Okay.
It's true. Here we go. Fantastic. Okay.
I got a snout for this kind of thing, I'm going to tell you.
The Way to Eden. A group of countercultural idealists hijack the Enterprise in search of a mythical planet they call Eden. They find it, only to discover the soil is poisonous, killing them slowly as they celebrate their arrival.
Question.
Yeah?
Did Colin help you write these?
He helped me abridge them.
But you came up with all the ideas yourself?
Yes, I picked these.
In which case, that's true.
That's true.
Yeah. If Colin had written it, that was a lie, but because you wrote it, that's true.
The Frozen Mission. Kirk and Spock are stranded on a frozen planet after a shuttle navigation error during a routine assignment. As conditions worsen, their cooperation collapses into paranoia and aggression, while Starfleet assumes the mission is proceeding normally.
Now that very much could be true. That sounds like a true one. So I'm going to say true. I think it's probably a cult episode for some fans, but not a good one.
You're wrong. That's actually...
That one's false.
That's The Sopranos, the Pine Barrens episode.
Well, I was actually thinking it's not a bad description of a part of what happens in this film.
Okay. The Contaminant. A near-invisible organism escapes into the Enterprise's engineering section during routine maintenance. Kirk becomes consumed with destroying it, drawing Spock and McCoy into an obsessive hunt that overtakes all other duties.
False.
Yep. Do you know what that really is?
That's, isn't that, the one with Morpheus in?
No, that's a Breaking Bad, The Fly episode.
Oh, okay, fine, Breaking Bad, no, that makes sense. I was thinking of it as, that sci-fi horror, what's it called? It begins with E.
Event Horizon.
Event Horizon. I was thinking of Event Horizon.
Nice. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
No, my bad. Okay, go on.
Plato's Stepchildren. The Enterprise encounter a society of telekinetic elites who rule through humiliation and cruelty. Kirk and Spock are forced to perform degrading acts for the ruler's amusement until suppressed powers emerge among the enslaved. That's a good one. That's real.
Yeah, it's called Plato's Children. It's definitely a Star Trek episode.
Turnabout Intruder. A scientist exchanges bodies with Kirk in order to take command of the Enterprise. The episode concludes by asserting that women are emotionally unfit for captaincy.
Oh, it's got to be true.
When was the last time you heard from your father?
Daddy. Whatever happened to Christopher Pine?
Oh, man. I actually I didn't know before I found out, and now I know.
I remember this made him big time. He'd popped up in Smoking Aces, I think.
Yeah.
And some other like smaller bits and bobs, but this launched him as a leading man, as one of the Christophers. There's Christopher Pratt, there's Christopher Pine, there's Christopher Hemsworth.
Yeah.
Any other Chris's? Are they the three?
Oh, you're leaning towards my other game.
Christopher Evans.
We'll come to that shortly.
We've got Evans, we've got Pratt, we've got... And so of all of those Chris's, he's definitely faded away as one of those leading men.
He has. I think the argument I would make, because the Chris's we're talking about are Hemsworth, Evans and Pratt, all of whom were in the Marvel universe, and all of whom have been in very big blockbusters. So in a sense, I'm not sure that Chris Pine, as far as like acting credibility goes, has really completely faded away. I think he's, you know, absolutely fine. He just pales in comparison to the scale of the other Chris's. He's clearly the smallest Chris in that notion.
He was in, you know, he's in the Star Trek series, so he's got, which obviously isn't the same as the Marvel.
No.
But even in terms of being the lead of a $40 million action movie, like they made him Jack Ryan,
yeah,
like an action lead, and that's not happening anymore.
No, but then the question is like maybe that's it could be a decision. You never know. He did some really. I mean, I think the arc of his career is really interesting. I note that his first real break was in The Princess Diaries 2 in 2004 as the romantic lead opposite Anne Hathaway. That's the first one where you look at him and you go, who's this young fella? What's he got, Adam? A little bit of charm, would you say?
Yeah, I imagine so. I've never seen it.
Well, also, like you said, he's in Smoking Aces. And I think that's, I might be a bit after Star Trek. But so Star Trek happens in 2009, which is then like a big mega break at that point. Like, as you say, he's going to be the lead in a film which is, as you described earlier, is like mainly made up of up-and-comers or, you know, people that are expected to be the next big thing. And the question, I suppose, for me would be like, is the case here that the film franchise doesn't really work or that he doesn't really work? Because I think he's quite good in this film. You know, he's like, he certainly is a good actor. And the obvious like jewel in the crown of his acting career for me comes in 2016, which is after his franchise work, where he's in Hell or High Water, and that for me is a moment where you go, okay, this guy's a real actor. This isn't just like movie star stuff. Maybe he was attractive, funny, and charming, and he had a lot of movie star charisma. So they try him out in the big franchise thing. Is it the franchise? Is it him? Unclear. It doesn't necessarily work. Turn around and go and do Hell or High Water. He's fucking amazing in that film. He's so good in that, and that's a really fantastic film. I think he's one of the best Chris's because of that. What do you think?
Well, yeah, but why is he not in more stuff like Hell and High Water?
I think maybe he made some weird choices, things that haven't really worked out. I mean, he's been in an awful lot of things that I haven't seen. That's part of the problem with this. The other thing we should say is that he did Wonder Woman as well.
Right, yeah, so that's, you know, that's it's not Marvel, it's DC, but he's pretty good as that kind of leading man, but then
sure.
he hasn't stayed... Of course, you say it's a choice. I think the choice was made for him. He's obviously better than Christopher Pratt, but I think maybe because we don't like Pratt.
Maybe, yeah.
For personal reasons.
Can you imagine Chris Pine in Jurassic Park? Jurassic World?
Yeah.
You could?
But I think Pratt is actually better at comedy than Pine. Pine has to do these comedic... He does okay. He doesn't embarrass himself. But... I don't hugely like it. I mean, the best, the Chris who is spans all of them, who can do both the big budget and maybe interesting stuff, I'd say maybe it's Hemsworth.
I think that's going to fade, though. My prediction about Chris Pine is that he's due a mid to late career comeback. I think he's made some not great choices. He's been in films that haven't worked out since he was in Star Trek, since he was in Wonder Woman. There are a couple of things that, you know, could have gone in a different direction and just didn't, right? But if he keeps working, which he will, I feel as though in the next 10 years he's going to do one or two films where that are going to catapult him back into not necessarily and certain, well, probably not certainly franchise work, but back into the kind of acting canon. I think he's going to get an Oscar nomination before the end of his career. That would be my Chris Pine related prediction. You think that's unfair?
No, I think that's good. I remembered. Yeah, he was in quite a fun flick called Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah.
And I have to take back my comedy comment, because he's actually quite fun and funny in that. I think maybe because he was better served by funny writer-directors in that, and he wasn't served by a funny writer-director with JJ. So, you know, I'm well up for that. If that's what he can do.
Well, listen, you've brought me a little sooner than I was expecting, but this isn't the only natural spot for my actual game.
Yeah.
Okay, the game is called The Chris's. Order the Chris's. Okay, say it back to me.
The Chris's, order the Chris's.
That's right. Now, as you said already, there's four Chris's. There's four Chris's. Chris Pratt, Chris Evans, Chris Pine, Chris Hemsworth. Chris Hemsworth. What I've got in front of me is five different categories, and I would like you to order my Chris's from 1 to 4 in each of the categories. You cannot get anything wrong, otherwise you lose. Okay? That's confusing. You have to get all four right in each category in order to get a point for the category. Okay? And the categories range from things that feel perhaps a little easier or maybe a little bit more standard to things that are a little bit more confusing. Okay?
Okay.
And there's a little bonus round at the end as well if you do well. So, let's start with category one, the Chris's. Age. Please, from oldest to youngest, put my Chris's in order. And I can tell you that there's only 4 years between all of them.
Oldest to youngest?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm going to go Evans as the oldest. Evans, Hemsworth, Pine, Pratt.
Very interesting. Very interesting. So you think Pratt's the youngest?
I think Pratt's the youngest.
Pratt's the oldest.
Oh!
Pratt is 46. He was born in 1979. Then Chris Evans, Cap. I think you've put him oldest because he's Cap. He's got all the authority. He's second oldest. He's 44, a full 2 years younger than Pratt. And Chris Pine is 43. And Chris Hemsworth is the youngest. He's 42.
Well, as I live and breathe.
As you live and breathe, indeed.
Blow me now, down with a feather.
This one's a little easier, I think. A little easier. Although there is some controversy about this one. Height. As you know, often the real height of people can be misleading on the internet. But can you please order my Chris's from tallest to shortest, please?
I bet they're all short as fuck. Okay, Hemsworth, tallest. Then Pratt, then Evans, then Pine.
You can have that. So technically, it's Pine, then Evans, but it's a fractional amount. And actually, the internet claims that they are all 6 foot or over. I'm sure that's not the case. But Chris Hemsworth is 6'3". Apparently, I think that is fair enough to be true. Anyway, he did play Thor. Chris Pratt is apparently 6'2", although here is the most controversy, because Chris Pratt often appears a lot shorter than some of these other people on camera. So it's possible that he isn't 6'2", but who the hell knows? Chris Pine and Chris Evans are both listed as 6 foot. So you can have that as a correct guess.
Thanks.
Now, moving on to number three. Acting nominations, major and minor combined. Okay, so it's not crazy. It's not in the hundreds or anything. It's in the tens. Can you please, in order of the most received acting nominations, including TV, so not just for films, list my Chris's in order of the most to the fewest acting nominations.
Pratt number one, Hemsworth number two, Evans number three, and Pine number four.
Now, this is fascinating. This is fascinating, Richmond, because you've got the middle two correct and you've got the outer two the wrong way round. Chris Pratt has the fewest nominations. He's because obviously they're mostly in his genre and fan awards as well. Chris Pratt only has just over 10. Chris Pine has the most with 35 acting nominations. And then in the middle, you got it right, Chris Hemsworth with 30 and Chris Evans with 20. Can I have your reaction, please?
What's Pine getting these noms for?
Just being a fucking cool guy. Also, he's in loads of TV, right?
Is he?
I think maybe he was in loads of TV.
Okay.
I think he might just be hitting his stride in TV and we're not seeing it, you know?
Right. I didn't realise he was doing TV. But yeah, blow me down with a feather.
There you go. Okay, number four, category four, net worth. From most to least, order my Chris's.
I'm going to go, it's also tallies with probably who's the most evil. Pratt, Evans, Hemsworth, Pine.
Now, this one's very interesting. I'm not sure you can be fairly scored on this because there are obviously different reports of this in different places. In the list I have in front of me now, Pratt is actually third. There's not much in it. Chris Hemsworth is number one with 130 million. Chris Evans is number two with 110 million. Chris Pratt number three with 100. And then Chris Pine, a lowly 35, would make sense. There are some lists that would suggest that Chris Pratt has more than the other two, because obviously he was also in Jurassic World, as well as being in, you know, Avengers and Guardians and whatever. But I think maybe being in all of the Avengers films is just enough to put the net worth of these other two guys up. That's why I went with this list in the end. Okay, but that one leads us into the next one, the final real round, which is box office total. Now, this is, Colin helped me work this out, so we'll just have to go with it. It makes sense to me, but what do you think? And the only one I don't have a number for is Chris Pine, who obviously
he's
is
last. Yeah, because he's last. You don't need a fucking number.
You don't.
Johnny
need a number.
Come last.
Yeah. So what do you think? What's order my Chris's?
Order by Chris's. It's interesting because yes, Evans is cap, but Pratt has probably been in more of the flicks across all of the lot, you know?
Well, absolutely, because he was in Avengers, the Endgame one, wasn't he? He was in all the Guardians that did well. He was in Jurassic World.
Yeah.
As you mentioned, he's been in many of these films. So that's an interesting working theory. You have heavy MCU presence for the other two, don't you? But what's enough?
Well, so yeah, I'm going to say Pratt, number one, then Hemsworth, then Evans, and then Pine.
What's your justification for putting Hemsworth ahead of Evans?
Because he was in more Thors.
Mm.
More Thors?
That was my favourite of the Thor films, more Thors.
More Thors.
I was really surprised how many more Thors there were.
Yeah, just so many. I mean, in the multiverse, that's what you get. That's what that lovely door opens for you. More Thors, please!
You would have thought that they devalue Thor by having more of them, but I don't know. Who am I to question what Marvel do?
Yeah, you're nobody, so just shut the fuck up.
You're right.
Yeah.
Not about that, but you're right about the box office total order. Congratulations. Yes. That's absolutely bang on. You've got 3 out of 5 there. Do you want to make it 50%, play the bonus round?
Oh, man.
Hi, everybody. I'm Cameron.
Budget brackets estimated, please, for start.
Oh, should we play the box office game? Sorry, yeah. I don't think we introduced it. Should we play the box office
game? I'd love to, yeah. Would you like to?
Yeah, more games. Games.
There's another one immediately after this as well. So,
yeah, you know. That's more of a, it's not of a game. It's a format. Well, you told me not to call it a game.
Well,
you said don't call it a game.
Budget brackets estimated, please, for Star Trek 2009. Star Trek 2009. What do you think?
Well, they're going to be spending a pretty penny on this kind of caper, aren't they?
They're going to be spending, for sure.
Launching the... It's Paramount's, you know, one of the jewels in their crown.
It's Paramount's A New Hope.
It's Paramount's Rocky Balboa. Although that also is theirs.
Yeah, that's quite good. It's Paramount's South Park.
It's Paramount's Doctor Who.
Right, yeah. I mean, I actually think it's like more like Paramount's EastEnders, you know?
Do you think?
No, I don't really think that.
No.
More of a Corrie thing.
Right. Not Emmerdale?
Definitely not. It's not a farm thing, is it?
No. Brookside?
I never watched that one. Was that the one in Bristol?
No, that was it was in Liverpool.
Liverpool?
Yeah.
Brookside. Liverpool. Which one was in Bristol?
Hello, My Lover?
Yeah. That's the one. Yeah.
Do you not remember Hello, My Lover?
I think I have a vague memory of it. Maybe if you talk about it more, things will come back to me. What happened in it?
Well, it was set. They're all set on in a it was in a particular area. This one was in Bristol.
Yeah.
But it was set
where they say it's a clever title, isn't it? Because the people of Bristol say their catchphrase is "Hello, my lover."
Hello, my lover, and it was set in a farmer's market, and it represented very much the kind of the hippie lifestyle side to Bristol, and the market was called My Lover, and so people would go in and they would go, "Oh, hello, my lover." And they'd say it anyway, but also they were saying every time they would walk in the farmer's market, they would introduce themselves to this farmer's market.
Yeah.
People would sell kimchi, and there was the kimchi salesman, Jim, and then there was Joan. She did hemp. She weaved hemp skirts.
She wove hemp skirts.
Yeah, she wove them.
Wow.
It was a lot. It was really, like, detailed about what they all did. There wasn't very much drama.
No.
There was just a lot of chat every single episode. They would just... each stall member would just explain their particular thing, and they would talk about sustainability a lot. And
right.
But that's
I do remember an episode now. Wasn't there an episode called "It's Better Than London Here? Why Don't You Live Here? It's Better Than London"? And then at the end of the episode, everyone realised that wasn't true. And actually, that was just something that people who lived there said, despite the fact that it's evidently not the case that Bristol is better than London. And that's when the show got cancelled, because everyone had decided they were fucking sick of it, actually. And if there was going to be a place that was better than London, it certainly wouldn't be Bristol. It would be one of like 10 or 11 other UK cities before Bristol. That's right, isn't it?
I'm going to say 140 mil.
Come on, man. Every time a movie like this comes around, it's always the same. They have a stock amount of money they give for this film. And you always
million.
Refuse to answer that with that. You always say 160, 140. Oh, is it 145? No, it's 150 every time. Every time it's 150. You never answer that, and it bothers me. Come on. Next time we have a 150 million movie, you better say it, okay?
I just don't want to play your game.
This is your game.
Right, but like you've got this meta game.
It's not your game, it's my game. Anyway.
Right, well, I didn't say it was. You're the one who said that.
You accepted that it was your game.
And then the way you said it, I mean, it was not your game. Like, I'm the one who said it. You've invented something to wind yourself up. And then
opening weekend, US and Canada, May the 10th.
May the 10th what?
2009. May the 10th be with you, 2009.
Right. May, summer. The big summer box office.
Yeah. I mean, they're encroaching on Star Wars time, aren't they, here? Which, of course, is May the 4th.
Well, Star Wars, of course, is not knocking about.
No, I'm just saying May the 4th was still a Star Wars day every year at that point. So releasing it near the May the 4th weekend. Yeah, because May the 4th be with you.
Christ, people who do that need to have a word with themselves. Star Wars Day. Fuck off.
Anyway, how much money do you think this took on the opening weekend?
I'd be interested to know what other flicks are knocking about this summer. What are the other summer blocks?
Let me tell you. Okay, let
summer
me tell
block
you.
Blusters.
Movies in the cinema in May 2009. May the 1st, so the week before Star Trek, X-Men Origins Wolverine was released.
Dear. So don't tell me specific dates, because I don't want to guide. I'm just generally like, what's the summer vibe?
Oh, okay, fine. X-Men Origins Wolverine.
Yeah, stinker.
That was out. Angels and Demons. Do you want to hear something very sad?
That was written by Dan Brown.
That is sad. No. My dad died in May 2009. That's when he died. He died. He never got to see Star Trek. He died.
I thought you were going to say he never got to see Angels and Demons.
No, he didn't get to see that either. That's sad. He died 4 or 5 days before Star Trek was released. So, God bless him. He never got to see Star Trek. But the first movie I went to see in the cinema after he died was Angels and Demons. I went with my sister because we were just sick of like mourning stuff and grief and family being around. We were like, let's get out of it. Let's go to the cinema. We went to see Angels and Demons, and it was the first time I ever left the cinema halfway through. And years later, I looked back upon that and I thought, maybe I didn't give that film a fair shout. It was 2 weeks after my dad died, and I put it back on. This was like 10 years later, and I turned it off halfway through. Not out of homage to my dead father, but because it is a truly, truly shit film. Really bad. Anyway, still in the cinema, Up. That was the next film I went to see after Angels and Demons. Boy, oh boy, did I enjoy that. That was good. Other things, Night at the Museum, Battle of the Smithsonian. That was going on. Terminator Salvation was going to be released that month.
Crikey.
Ghosts of Girlfriends Past. There you go. There's another May 2009 film we've covered on this podcast. And then beyond that, still knocking about Monsters vs. Aliens, 17 again, The Soloist, Drag Me to Hell.
No, just the big, I just want the big summer block. Like, just
Fast and
big...
Furious was still playing. That was released a month before, but it was still playing. So was Taken. That was still in the cinema as well. How about that? But that had been in the cinema for a good few months at that point.
Yeah, nothing mega or iconic, really, aside from...
Wolverine was big.
No, not Wolverine Origins. That was an absolute stinker.
Was it? What did we do on this podcast?
We did Logan.
Oh, we did Logan. I'm thinking of Logan. Okay.
Yeah, you're thinking of Logan.
Yeah, I was thinking that's very early for Logan. That doesn't tie up at all.
No, it was a real stinker. Ryan Reynolds.
We should do this more, by the way. What else was in the cinema when this film came out? I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, no, it's a great idea I had. Well done, me.
Well done, you.
So let's say, I think people were up for this, because even though it's a recognizable property, but it's like, ooh, exciting trailer, this is going to be fun. Mm-hmm. So I think it'll open okay, and I think it'll open in the ballpark, in the jumper ballpark of, say, 34 mil.
You think so?
Above.
You think that's in the jumper ballpark?
No, I don't. I know it's not. That's out of the ballpark. Yeah, that's jumper territories. But it's a different ballpark I'm going into. But I want to be in the ballpark, and so above jumper territory, 34.
You are not in the ballpark, though. This is Star Trek. Everyone loves Star Trek. People
they don't
see this shit.
They don't. Not everyone loves Star Trek.
Oh, everyone loves Star Trek.
They don't.
Oh.
People make fun of it.
Everyone loves Star Wars. You know, we have two territories. There's two famous territories on this podcast, isn't there? One of them's Jumper. What's the other one?
Logan.
And this is Logan territory. It's 75 million it took on its opening weekend. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Gross worldwide. Let's get there. What are we taking?
Well, it's going to make about 680 mil.
It does not. The 10x rule doth not apply here, sir. In fact,
that means the 10x rule doesn't make sense or work.
It made $385 million.
Shall we do the bit of the show? It's not a game.
No, it's definitely not a game.
Where one of us reads out a list of movies they forgot, with a view to catching the other one out on a movie they forgot.
Yes.
To choose the next show we're going to do.
We shall. I think it's my turn, because you got me on Star Trek, didn't you?
I did. I got you on four others as well. But
yeah, that's true. Although they've been adjudged by the Discord community to not be Forgot You Forgot, so I think we're going to have to do special episodes of those. Right. My list is very much dictated by the fact that next week, because I'm talking to my friend Paul about it, I have to watch Ocean's 12, okay? So that's the other film I'll be watching next week. I just watched Ocean's 11, now I'll be watching Ocean's 12. So I don't really want any... I couldn't handle any more kitschy fun. I need something a little different. you know, I need a sort of milk and vinegar type situation here. So if milk is Ocean's 12, then vinegar is
Schindler's List. Schindler's...
then vinegar is oh god, it's so long. Oh, the first Resident Evil with Mila. Is it no? What's her name?
Mila Jovovich.
Yeah, Mila Jovanovic or whatever.
I know I've seen that.
Is it a deep plum?
I worry that it's too bad to count.
Right.
And that it was forgotten. I forgot it purposefully.
They made a lot of those films though. And I think people like it, I think. I don't know that it is.
Is that important that people like it? What's that got to do with anything?
I don't know. I'm not sure. But they did make several more of them, didn't they? They made sort of 7 or 8 of them, I think. So it can't have been that bad. Because if it was really... Oh, hang on. Fast and Furious.
Hang on a sec. Is this another one of your rules? Because I think your rule systems are deeply flawed.
I'll give you another option if you want.
Let's keep it, mm-hmm. But I don't want to necessarily veto it because I do. It's interesting that you think that's the most vinegar to Ocean's 12.
I don't. I was going to say a different film, but then I panicked and said Resident Evil instead. If Ocean's 12 is milk, then Resident Evil is more like orange juice, you know? So they still don't go together, but it's not full vinegar.
Yeah, because we were chatting about Underworld, and I said I hadn't watched it, and you were like, oh, you should watch it. And I put it on, and it was just unbearable, unwatchably bad.
Right.
And I worry that Resident Evil is in that same ballpark.
I've seen it several times on video, but not for about 20 years. I do remember the scene with the zombie dogs, and there's a kind of sexy guy and a sexy girl, and they're all sort of doing guns.
There's a bit with lasers, a laser bit.
Oh, the laser bit where the person gets all cut into the dice, and yeah, the diced up laser bit. Yeah, that's right at the end, I think.
Yeah, I don't think we can do it.
No, okay, let's not do it. Fine. Here's a forget you forgot. Now, people won't agree with this.
Doesn't matter. It's us. It's whether I agree with it.
The Godfather. That's vinegar. That's the most vinegar.
Have you got time for The Godfather?
I got time for The Godfather. The reason I say The Godfather, and we've talked about this previously, is I'm dangerously close to starting to say that The Godfather isn't a good film because everyone likes it so much and everyone's always saying it's the greatest film. And I haven't seen it for quite a long time. And I've watched it a couple of times, and I know it is a good film, but also I think it's nowhere near as good a film as a film would need to be good to be the best film. And I'm just becoming that guy in the pub, you know? And I think you are too.
I've seen it twice, I think. I would have seen it in my late teens, you know, got to watch it. And then maybe in my early 30s.
Yeah.
This is not, I've said this before, like, I'm a Goodfellas guy. I'm more of a Scorsese hot dose of crank.
Hot dose of scorse.